Well, good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you listen to. They happen to be my views and, well, the views of, certainly of our guests. And this evening our guest is going to be Ron Brown, who is involved in the financial business, gold and silver, and he supports Radio Liberty. We certainly support him, and we always look forward to having him onto our programs. How are you doing tonight, Ron?
Be with you, Dr. Stan. I'm doing fine.
All right. Well, tell us what's happening from your point of view. Certainly they've been playing games with gold and silver recently. Now, obviously, somebody's manipulating the price of these things. They were doing so well for a while. They've certainly headed south recently, but are your customers as much more interested today than they were a few months ago in purchasing gold and silver?
It's really strange, Dr. Stan. In the last week or two, we've had a $4 correction in 2 days in the silver market. I think gold was down over $100 in that same 2 days. And yet I did not have one client call on the panic to sell their gold or their silver. Now, granted, I had a lot of people saying, what's going on? You know, how are they manipulating it? But most of them were calling to buy. And I probably had the biggest month of sales that I've had since I've been in the business for almost 30 years. So it tells me that this all these manipulation machinations they go through to hold the price down are starting to fall on deaf ears, because most people have seen through it. They've been doing this for the last, what, 5-6 years, trying to beat it down, but it always comes right back up. So people are starting to see through the charade right now.
Well, I think people know that something's seriously wrong. In fact, the big news, of course, is the fact that Henry Paulson and some other people high in the government are talking about creating a whole new situation where the Federal Reserve System will be given a great deal of power now to regulate the whole financial industry, really. Have you been reading much about that?
I've been reading some excerpts of it, and you know, I don't think we know enough to really speak in great detail about it, other than to say it's the same old story. They create the crisis, and then they use the crisis to consolidate power. And that's exactly what they're trying to do.
And you know, what the most amazing thing is, the Federal Reserve is a private organization. It is not a government organization. The Federal Reserve was created back in 1913 to enrich the international bankers. It did a great job. Of course, we were told they were going to stabilize our currency. Well, the dollar, you know, that we had at that time, that would be worth about $100 today, maybe at least $97 or $98. They've effectively destroyed the value of our dollar. The reason the price of oil is going up is because the price of our dollar is going down. And if we had the dollar today that we had in the year 2000, probably oil would be selling at about $30 a barrel. So they've destroyed effectively the value of our currency, and now they're going to give these same people who really should be tried for treason power over the whole financial industry. I mean, this is the most incredible thing I've ever heard. Are we ready to believe that the people who put MTBE into our gasoline so it would be safer, we can trust them with the entire financial future of our country?
You know, a perfect example of what you're talking about is Bear Stearns was the fifth largest brokerage firm in the country. They were going down on a Friday afternoon, what, 2 weeks ago or a week ago, whenever it was. The stock closed at $26 a share, and then over the weekend on a Sunday night, they determined they had serious problems, and they triggered or orchestrated a buyout where J.P. Morgan stepped in and was going to buy out the company for $2 a share.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, Ryan, you go right ahead. You were talking about how something, the stock simply fell apart, went down to $2 a share. Now they're talking about putting out $10 a share for it. But Bear Stearns is one of the best-run companies in this entire nation. I think that they were simply targeted by the people at J.P. Morgan Chase, and with the help of the Federal Reserve, they simply destroyed their competitor.
Well, that's obviously part of it, and I think it's the main factor because, as I read, Bear Stearns didn't go along with the bailout of long-term capital management way back when, and as I always say, there's no honor among thieves, so they came down on Bear Stearns, and just the building in New York City, as I understand, is worth $1.2 billion. But the main thing is that they're bailing out the big boys. J.P. Morgan is getting a freebie, in a sense, while the stockholders and the employees of Bear Stearns are getting clobbered. You know, they're laying off, I understand, about half of the labor force, and 30% of the shareholders were the employees of the company. So the little guys, again, got wiped out, and the big boys walk away with the big toys. So, and as I understand it, and you can probably correct me, J.P. Morgan is one of the shareholders of the Fed itself, right?
I think it is the largest single shareholder of the Federal Reserve Bank. So the little wonder that the Federal Reserve Bank is going to give them some $30 billion. They wouldn't give it to Bear Stearns to help them, but they give it to J.P. Morgan to facilitate their buyout of Bear Stearns. And now, of course, the Fed routinely or regularly up until recently would lend only to commercial banks, not to investment banks, which, of course, is primarily what Bear Stearns was an investment bank, and a very, very profitable investment bank. In fact, about a year and a half ago, its stock was selling at $170 a share, and a poor old English billionaire went in and bought $1 billion worth of that stock, and saw it go all the way down to $2 a share, now up to $10 a share. But what they're really doing, is simply enriching the already rich, and certainly the stockholders of Bear Stearns, as you said, are going to lose their shirts and everything else. Their life savings are going to be destroyed. But this is an example of how the Federal Reserve System is helping one of the favored banks. Remember that J.P. Morgan Chase is a Rockefeller-controlled bank, and the Rockefeller-controlled bank is going to get a $30 billion loan from the Fed to help to take over Bear Stearns. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Ron was simply commenting upon the dishonest way that Bear Stearns has been wiped out. Here's a very, very effective corporation, one of the most prosperous ones on Wall Street, which was run much better than J.P. Morgan Chase, much better than Morgan Stanley, much better than Merrill Lynch, much better than most of the companies there, but this is the one they targeted, and they destroyed it. How did they destroy it? Well, they got the people who were lending them money simply to demand the money back. And, certainly when you lend money into an investment bank, you have the right to withdraw that money. And they had adequate money, and then over a weekend, suddenly all the money was called in, and Bear Stearns was there without any financing at all. Everything invested, and much of course had been invested, in these collateralized debt obligations or these other monetary increments, which really are totally insolvent, which were the Fed allowed to be created. They were certainly, some people refer to them as toxic waste. They are basically a bundled home mortgages that don't pay, a bundled student loans that don't pay, a bundled automobile loans. Of course, a lot of people aren't paying off their automobile loans. And as a result, Bear Stearns was in real financial problems. And suddenly somebody gave orders that all of their collateral was to be called in, and Bear Stearns actually now is in a situation where they're going to be picked up at $10 a share, where this stock should probably be $50 to $100 a share, and they were probably one of the finest banks, investment banks in the country, and they were targeted for takeover, and with the help of the Federal Reserve System, J.P. Morgan Chase, a Rockefeller-controlled bank, simply absorb Bear Stearns and What happens is the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. Go right ahead, Ron.
You know, of course, Bear Stearns wasn't totally blameless. They got caught up in this high leverage CDOs and mortgage-backed securities, so they left themselves vulnerable. But all of this could not have happened if it hadn't been for the Fed under Greenspan just pulling out every rabbit out of his hat for the last, what, 6, 7, 8 years to keep the bubble going. And they made it so possible for these bankers to become greedy. They always felt like the Fed was there to bail them out. And so they just got in deeper and deeper and deeper on higher and higher leverage. And whenever you do that, then you're setting yourself up for a fall. And that's exactly what Bear Stearns fell into. But, of course, all the other major investment houses and banks are in similar trouble. So it's going to be interesting to see what new rabbit they can pull out of their hat to bail it out this time.
Well, of course, I think one of the biggest things about Bear Stearns, what nobody really wants to talk about, is the fact that they had written $13.4 trillion of and that $13.4 trillion in derivative contracts. In other words, that was guaranteed that these collateralized debt obligations and asset-backed securities and certainly the structured investment vehicles that were out there, that they would actually make payments, that the people who actually could put the bonds together would make their proper payments on the bonds. And, of course, if those derivatives had gone down, the whole house of cards would have gone down. The derivatives are simply insurance policies that are written without any money behind them. I mean, they may have a few, $100 billion behind them, but when you've got something like $13.4 trillion in derivatives, they couldn't let Bear Stearns go bankrupt, and so they had to step in, and of course, they precipitated the whole crisis. And now Bear Stearns stockholders are going to be left holding the bag, and it's unfortunate, but I feel that the whole monetary system is going to be brought down. I think that's exactly what they want, because the people who really run the government, the people who really hold the wealth of our country, hate America. They do not want a sovereign nation. They believe in a world government and a world religion and a world leader. Now, you can't really get that world government as long as you have sovereign nations with, of course, their own monetary system. That's why they need to destroy our monetary system if they're going to bring about this one world monetary system and the one world government. And I really believe that before we get through with this, we'll either have the Amero, another type of currency, or a global currency, and I lean more towards a global currency. I think that's eventually where they intend to take us. But first, they have to destroy our monetary system, and they're doing a pretty good job of it, don't you think?
Absolutely. And, you know, if you go back and look at the history of the Fed, you can see them methodically, step by step, just consolidating power within the system and setting the stage for this one-world government. If you go back to the inception of the Fed, in fact, if you go back to the beginning of our nation, just for a little overview, when we completed the Revolutionary War, and you had these 13 colonies that knew they had to come together and form a government to protect themselves from Great Britain coming back over to take them back, they were very, very skeptical of an all-powerful government, so they created something called the Articles of Confederation, and that gave such limited power to the federal government. And remember, they didn't have any money to speak with, so they started their own script. It wasn't gold backed by gold or anything. It was called the Continental Dollar, and that's where the term came from, ain't worth a continental, because it didn't last more than 2 or 3 years. But they had to go back to the drawing board, and in 1791 is when they came out with the Constitution, redefined the dollar as a specific amount of gold and or silver. And under that gold-backed system for 122 years up to 1913, the dollar maintained its value almost 100%. So a loaf of bread in 1913 cost the same as it would back in 1791. So it shows you the stability if you have a currency that's backed by specie or gold or silver. And in 1913, they created this Federal Reserve Act, which gave this power to these international bankers, because the Fed is really, as we've discussed many times, a private corporation. Now, the point I want to make, though, is that when the Fed was created, It was given the authority to finance the deficits of the federal government, and that's all. So when the federal government ran a deficit of, let's say, $5 billion, which was a lot back then, the Treasury could issue IOU notes called a Treasury bond or a Treasury note, give them to the Fed, and the Fed could accept those as collateral to print money out of nothing and loan it to the government. And now the government's paying an interest on something that was created out of nothing. But step forward to 1980, when the system really started to fall apart. And in 1980, that's when gold hit 870s. Silver was at $52 an ounce. You'll remember interest rates were running 21%. And here was Jimmy Carter going into January, trying to go into an election year with the economics like that. Didn't bode well for his chances of re-election, of course. But what they did is they passed something called the Monetary Control Act of 1980, which totally changed the whole relationship of the Fed. The first thing it did was force all banks, and back then, every bank didn't have to become a member of the FDIC. It forced all banks to become a member. Secondly, it gave the Fed the authority to take the reserve requirements to whatever level they deem necessary, which allows them to print money at any rate they want to.
If you have
a reserve requirement of 10%, that means $1,000 invested in the banking system can be parlayed into $10,000 of loan. So that gives the Sprax Reserve banking system the ability to create lots and lots of money and debt in the circulation. But the important thing it did, the thing it's affecting us today, is it changed the definition of collateral under the Federal Reserve Act to mean anything they deem necessary. So when they start coming in here, like you just mentioned, to bail out these investment banks, which they couldn't do before, it's now legal under the Fed. So they can bail out some tin-horn dictator in Brazil or Mexico or wherever, and they've been doing that, of course, the last 20-something years, and that's why we have this massive debt system and hyperinflation that's building to a crescendo and is about ready to collapse.
And, of course, the average American cannot believe that this system could collapse, and yet it is beginning to collapse. We have a collateralized debt obligation, a bubble. We have a hedge fund bubble. We have a derivative bubble. I mean, the collateralized debt obligation bubble is somewhere between $600 billion and $3 trillion, various estimates from various people. But the hedge fund bubble, and these, of course, these investment groups that are out there, they have countless billions of dollars that they've invested, but they've invested it unwisely because it's highly leveraged. Their bubble is going to run about $13 trillion, an awful lot of money. That's all equivalent to the entire gross domestic product of the United States for a year. And all of that could simply vanish overnight. But the one that is most frightening of all is the derivative bubble. And that is somewhere between $500 and $700 trillion. There's not that much money, not a tenth that much money in the entire world today. In fact, all the currency and all the wealth of all the world is only about $45 trillion, but the derivative bubble is between $500 and $700 trillion. And when that bubble comes cascading down, and that's the thing that everybody's really concerned about, but they're not telling the public about it, it means that they simply destroy the value of our currency, and we will end up in Sydney, as they are over in Rhodesia today, in what we refer to as Zimbabwe, that country where the United States State Department installed a Marxist dictator named Mugabe, and there, of course, their inflation rate is 100,000% a year. 100,000% a year. And there it costs you $3 million for a soft drink, $1.5 billion for, to fill up your tank of gas. You're not allowed to take more than $500 million out of any bank at any one time, but it's only really equivalent to about $14 American. I can remember when I lived in Africa, it took $2 American to buy one Rhodesian dollar. And now, of course, 500 million Rhodesian dollars buy you 14 American dollars. That's the end result of an irresponsible financial system, one that was imposed by the American State Department. Maybe it was just a trial. A trial for maybe, but could that happen here? We'll pick up the story there, Ron. Because well, certainly
like
the inflation
to, if you don't mind, Dr. Stan, is pick up where you mentioned the hedge funds and their high leverage and the part they play in this manipulation of the gold and the silver market, in fact, all of the markets. But you know, our whole financial system is built on a mountain of debt. And the hedge funds trade leverage contracts, as you mentioned, and much of that through the futures market. And that is the way they manipulate the price of gold and silver. For example, as of last week, the open interest on the futures market just for silver was over 500 million ounces. It was over 100,000 contracts. And each contract is worth 5,000 ounces. So if you have an open interest of 500 million ounces and it's being traded by hedge funds who are leveraging themselves 10, 15, and 20 to 1, you can see where you set the stage that the big boys can manipulate the market. But to the people who have never discussed the futures market, let me just take a second to explain very simply how it works. Let's say, Dr. Stan, just as an example, you believe silver is going to go up. Or let's put it the other way. I want you to be the winner on this one.
No, thank you very much.
You believe silver is going to go down, but I believe silver is going to go up. So I go to my futures, my commodity broker, and I buy a contract of silver. And let's use $20 as the cost of silver at that time. It's a 5,000-ounce contract, so I just purchased the controlling interest of $100,000 worth of silver, but the down payment or the margin that I had to put up in order to trade that contract was somewhere around $5,000. So, in a sense, I'm able to leverage my money 20-fold. Now, the futures market is like a bookie operation in that for every buyer, there has to be a seller. So let's say you, on the other hand, think silver is going to go down, and you go to your broker and you put up $5,000 and you're betting it's going to go lower and I'm betting it's going to go higher. So in a sense, you and I have been pitted against each other. Well, go back to the silver market dropped $4 in 2 days. Well, my $5,000, $4 times 5,000 ounces is $20,000. I just lost $20,000 in 2 days, but I only put up $5,000. So I've lost four times the money that I have invested in 2 days. You, on the other hand, are sitting there with the Cheshire Cat grin on your face because you have made $20,000. The problem, though, you have is that they took the $5,000 out of my account and put it into your account. Now you're saying, no, wait a minute, I just won $20,000. Where's my other $15,000? So in order for you to get your $15,000, the bookie that made the bets for us, or the broker, he has to make good on that. So he's going to come to me and say, Mr. Brown, you've got to put up another $20,000 if you want to keep that contract. $15,000 to pay the deficit on what you've already lost. And if you want to keep that contract, you have to put up another $5,000 initial margin. And if I don't do that, what does the broker have to do? He has to sell me out immediately, which creates selling pressure on the market because I'm selling in a market that's going down. So let's take that and take it to the macro level.
Hold that point. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Well, of course, what Ron was describing is how the future market works. One person will buy, and certainly probably with a 20-time leverage, 10-time leverage, will buy a contract that silver is going to go up. The other person buys a contract, says silver is going to go down. Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, never get involved in the futures market. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. Playing the futures market, the commodities market, is a good way to make a small fortune out of a large fortune. Do not get involved. But certainly it's very appealing to a lot of people. The only trouble is if it turns against you, they can end up with your house and everything else you own. So you have to have a certain amount of money that you're willing to put up there. It's a gamble, and it's a very, very dangerous gamble. But So go ahead with the story there, Ron.
Now let's take it to the macro level. We're sitting there with 500 million ounces of open interest on high leverage, and basically what you have is the hedge funds typically who are betting it's going to go up, and so they've leveraged themselves 20 to 1. But on the other side of the equation, remember I said you had to have a buyer and a seller. On the other side of the equation, you typically have three or four of these big international bankers, like Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs. Here comes Morgan Chase again, right? Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, etc. And as of about a week or two ago, they were short in excess, just three of these bankers, short in excess of 300 million ounces of silver. In other words, they had bet it was going to go down, and what they have been doing over the past months is whenever demand for silver would come into the futures market, they would take the short side to keep that demand from driving the price higher. But at some point, they get to where they've got such a massive short position, and they were losing their shirt because silver went from $15 to $21, and if you're short 300 million ounces, that's an awful lot of money to lose in a month and a half. So what they had to do was to find a way to orchestrate a panic sell-off in the silver market. And it's very easy to do when you're going up against these hedge funds, which are typically run by 35-year-old MIT graduates or who've been playing computer games all their life. But that's all they know. They have their little economic models, and they bet on high leverage with other people's money. So what the international bankers do is they sit back and wait until these hedge funds and these speculators are vulnerable. And the way they get vulnerable is when silver goes up that fast, one, they're making a fortune, and they get so caught up in their own brilliance that a lot of times what they'll do is parlay and take their profits and buy more contracts. The second thing they do, and this is where I think they really get them, is if you were the hedge fund manager, and let's say you had bought 1,000 contracts at 15, and a month and a half later it's trading at 16, and you've made a fortune, and this market has so much momentum, you're saying, gosh, you know, this market is at 21, but it looks like it could go to straight to 25 or maybe even 30 before it slows down, and I don't want to miss out on that. But by the same token, I don't want to lose all the profits I already have. So why don't I put in some trailing stops? That's where you're telling the broker, as long as the market's going up, just keep my contracts on. But if it ever drops, let's say we put our stop a dollar under the market, if it ever drops a dollar from the high, then immediately sell me out. So all these international bankers have to do at that point, and you better know that they know how many stops and where they are in the market at any given time, and they know exactly when to pounce. And that's all they have to do is once they see the opportunity, they just start selling and selling and selling and selling until they force the price down to those stops. And once you start to trigger those stops, they feed on each other and they just trigger what's called a margin massacre. And then you just flush all these hedge funds out of their positions. But you know what's interesting, Dr. Stan, is that if there was really a problem in the gold and the silver market with the fundamentals, then you would expect a flood of selling by people that own gold and silver. The reality, in 2 days, people came rushing in to buy gold and silver, and they have cleared the shelves. Every dealer I've talked with has very little to sell.
You're talking about silver now or gold?
And, well, gold too. Not quite as bad as gold, but if you ask them for gold eagles, they're back ordered. 3-4 weeks minimum. If you ask them for a Krugerrand, and Krugerrands used to be dime a dozen in the marketplace, they're still back ordered. But silver is where they're really back ordered. The Silver Eagle, which has been one of the favorite ways of buying silver the past 5-10 years, the U.S. Mint came out and made a strange statement. They said, "We are suspending production until we can catch up."
Why would you suspend, production? I would think you'd want to increase production rather than suspend production if you want to get caught up. Obviously, they're not telling the truth, but then when did government officials ever tell the truth? We'll be right back with Ron Brown. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Ron is just saying that there's a shortage of the American Eagle, which is minted by the United States Treasury, by the mint there. Well, are they going to go back into mint into production of the silver coins or not? Do we know?
Well, no one knows yet. But, you know, if you give them the benefit of the doubt that they were making an honest statement, the only thing you could read into that statement, you know, like a, how do you ever catch up if you don't produce? The only thing you could read into that statement is they don't have the raw silver to produce. But if you look at all the other markets, if you wanted 100-ounce bars, for example, last Friday or Friday before last, I had a client called, wanted to buy 70 100-ounce bars. I called my dealer. They had raised the premium from 30 cents an ounce to a dollar. They said, but we don't have any, and we're at least 4 weeks back ordered. I said, what about silver rounds? He says, don't even ask us about silver rounds. They're not available. We don't have any idea when they will be available. So basically, every form of silver, with the exception of the silver bags, and even they are hard to get. But if you call all the dealers in the country, most of them are running short. So, you know, I don't know if you remember, Dr. Stan, but several years ago, as you and I have talked about this, I said, one of these days, the shortage of silver will ultimately and finally manifest. And when that day comes, it will trigger a chain of events that will drive gold and silver, or at least silver, through the roof. And it will expose all of these gimmicks and these paper scams that have held the price of silver down for all these years. And, you know, it's starting to come out that... In fact, it came out with the story last week that the Perth Mint may be having trouble making deliveries, and that's where a lot of people store. They buy silver because they don't want to store it, and they store it at the Perth Mint. So there's a lot of these programs that supposedly store silver for you, and it's now starting to come out one by one that maybe a lot of these programs don't have the proper amount of silver behind them. I think that's going to be the scandal that really comes out over the next 1 to 2 years.
Well, of course, if that is the case, why the price of silver, as you say, would just go through the roof. How do we know, though, whether this is a real shortage or just a production shortage or simply they're running out of silver? Is there any way to tell?
Well, if they had the silver, then the dealers could find the silver at the refineries or whoever... wherever they go to pick up their silver. But the fact that they can't pick it up, you know, 100-ounce bars, Englehart apparently can't keep up with production, Johnson Matthey, obviously.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ron is saying that basically it would appear that there is a real shortage of silver. Certainly the mint has stopped a production of silver eagles, as they say that they are going to stop production so they can get caught up. Well, how do you get caught up if you stop production? And, of course, what's happened is apparently there's a real shortage of 100-ounce bars and 1,000-ounce bars and all sorts of silver products that ordinarily were readily traded by coin dealers. Just are not there. Ron was saying that silver rounds, which is simply a size of a silver dollar, usually 99.9% silver, with something stamped on it, not very beautiful like you might find with a silver eagle, but certainly very tradable as being silver, and they're just not available today. So the shortage of silver is beginning to manifest itself, and one of these days, of course, since silver is so much in demand for industry, and industry's got to have this for many things that they produce, well, I think we're going to see the price just going through the roof once, of course, the manipulation of the prices is over with. Well, before we go on, Ron, I want you to get your telephone number out, and I know that you do offer people some of the things that you've written if they get in touch with you. So how could people get in touch with you if they were learning more about what's happening in the market?
Okay, just call me at 1-800-595-0561. That's 1-800-595-0561.
All right, fine. And so if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Ron, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Now, You mentioned that there is at least some shortage in certain gold coins. You mentioned that the Kruger Rand, which has, of course, been an old staple for a long time, is there a premium on things like Kruger Rands and Austrian 100 Coronas and things like that?
You're starting to see the early stages. They've raised the premiums on just about everything. It's still an early stage of that. I don't think the gold market's going to be quite as critical as the silver market. People don't realize that over the last 60 years, the world has consumed probably 90 to 95% of all the silver that took 4,000 years of history to accumulate, because silver is so necessary in an industry, as you just mentioned. Gold, on the other hand, every year you have more gold above ground, so because gold isn't used nearly as much industrially as silver. So I think, you know, at some price, you'll always have gold. What people might want to consider is the types of gold for which you can't make any more of. There's still some bargains out there, in the, like the $20 gold pieces in AU's BU-type condition. You can buy them almost for bullion prices. You know, about almost the same price you'd pay for a one-ounce bullion gold eagle. So to me, that's kind of like a bird nest on the ground, because by definition, you can't make any more of those. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that the demand for gold is rising dramatically over the last 3 months, for sure, but actually over the last 5 years. So at some point, there will be a tremendous shortage of those type coins. You just have to be careful not to get ripped off by some coin dealer that's going to charge you 50 or 100 or 1,000, you know, 500% markup on them. But the silver, we're just flat running out of it, and I just believe it's the early stages of a panic state.
Well, of course, if the panic ever sets in, why, of course, the value of the silver will go right through the roof. And this really is what I think a lot of people have been anticipating for a long period of time. Right now, the gold-silver ratio is, what, about 50 to 1, 52, 53, something like that?
Yeah, it's gotten down in the 40s, and then, of course, this panic sell-off has taken it back up to 52, 53 last time I looked at it. So, you know, I've been saying for years, Dr. Stan, that the ratio is going to go down to 10 to 1 minimum. You know, it went to 17 to 1 back in 1980 when silver went to $52 and gold got as high as 870. But, you know, here we are 28 years later. We've been consuming more silver than we produce basically every year. And yet we've got 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 times as much paper money sloshing around the globe. So it makes you wonder where silver will go this time. You know, in 1979, it went from $5 to $52 an ounce in 12. So it makes you wonder just how far it will. And of course, I suspect before it gets to its real zenith, you'll see some type of a national emergency imposed, and we'll be pricing our gold or silver in something other than dollars.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Mike, did you have a question or comment for our guest?
Well, I did, and I'm from Coeur d'Alene.
Oh, Coeur d'Alene. Okay, I'm sorry. They got you down here. Mike from Santa Cruz. Mike from Coeur d'Alene.
Okay.
Well, it's good to have you, Mike, wherever you're from.
Well, thank you.
Is it pretty cold up there in Coeur d'Alene, or is it?
I noticed that today both silver and gold took large decreases.
Right.
And it's good to buy on the dips, no doubt about it. But if people aren't taking the actual possession of silver, or, I mean, they're starting to take actual possession of silver, why is the price continuing to drop, and how is the if it's manipulation, how is that manipulation being achieved?
All right. Duran, do you want to try to take that?
Yeah, I can't explain how they do it in the futures market. And you have these traders on the long side who have limited funds, and you have the international bankers on the short side who have unlimited funds. And once they're ready to drive the market down, they can just sell until they start triggering the stop-loss orders, and they create a margin massacre. Where if you've ever traded the futures market, you know what I mean. You can lose money so fast that way that it forces you out of the market.
actually haven't, and you just went right over my head with the long and the short of it.
Well, basically,
and
Mike,
you must have just tuned in, because I had explained how a futures contract has to have a buyer and a seller.
Right.
And a contract is 5,000 ounces. And the example I gave with Dr. Stan was I was betting silver was going to go up, and he was betting it was going to go down. We each put up $5,000 and control a 5,000-ounce contract, and a silver contract, and silver drops $4 in 2 days. Well, I just lost $20,000 on a $5,000 bet.
Well, I think the thing, Mike, you have to understand is that the people who are holding the massive contracts, we're talking about Goldman Sachs, you're talking about the Japanese major banks, and they work in concert together, and all they have to do is just start selling at a lower price, and that lowers the price of silver. And then the next contract, they sell it at a lower price, and they drive the price down, just the same way that if you wanted to raise the price, why, you would see, bid the price up. Here they bid the price down, and as they bid the price down, it gets to falling, and of course then the people who have bought it long, but they've got stops in, of course you go past their stops, and they are automatically sold out of the market, and it begins
now
to feed
paper,
on itself.
That's just EMF paper trading. There's no actual commodity being acquired, correct?
Oh, exactly.
Well, what they're doing is they're selling it, but the thing is
that a bucket shop gambling on the price of silver.
Right.
It would be the equivalent of you and me gambling a Notre Dame against Slippery Rock. We can bet $1 million on the game, but we really have no effect on the outcome, do we?
No.
And you see, the where you can really, of course, play this the other direction, and let me tell you, you should not be in the commodity market, but if you had, say, $20 million and you were to buy those long contracts and then you were to demand delivery, it may very well be that the people who promised delivery don't have any silver. And so they've got to go out and do everything they can to buy the silver, and they'll have to pay whatever price is being asked. Maybe it'll be $25 an ounce before they can buy it. So this is how the system works. And there's more and more in people take delivery on silver, they're going to drive the price up. Not right now, they're driving it down by selling silver that they don't even own.
Yeah,
anyway, thanks very much. Anything else you wanted to ask, Mike?
Each contract has an option to take delivery.
Right.
99% of the time, there people are just trading, as a speculator. But you might have some film companies, Kodak, or some other companies that have to have silver to survive, and they may have long contracts, and they may step up to the plate, and they will at some point and say, okay, I've got a contract for 100,000 ounces, I want to take delivery, and the other side has to either deliver or they're in deep trouble. And the reality is they don't have the silver to deliver, and that's what's called a silver squeeze. And when that happens, silver will go up dramatically.
And remember that old adage, Mike, he who sells what isn't his'n has to give it back or go to prison. And, of course, one of these days, I hope a lot of those people end up going to prison. Thanks so much for calling.
Hey, Dr. Stan.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, Mike's gone. Now we've got Mark calling from Florence, Oregon. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Oh, fine, Dr. Stan. I hope you're well tonight. You sound great.
Yeah, well, I'm really feeling pretty good.
Well, I could tell. Hi, Ron. How are you doing?
Just fine, sir.
Ron, I really respect what you're saying as far as your knowledge. You seem to have a complete knowledge of the way things work and all the facets, particularly this evening you're discussing relative to the precious metals market, I think is pretty much what it centers on. And I'm really curious as to what vehicles or what conditions will come about that are really going to put a sharp curtailment to this manipulation of the market. I mean, when you can't find silver, essentially, I mean, I'm sure it can be found, but it's getting more scarce all the time, from what I gather that you say. And when the market goes down, you know, almost 70 cents a day, I think it was, when silver is scarce in a jump like that, what is the conditions, what you're going to come about, what you're going to end the the possibility or the means by which they manipulate.
Very good question, and that's really the point I really wanted to make tonight, and that is it's ended. Once the physical shortage starts to manifest, then all of these manipulation schemes are going to eventually be exposed to the fraud they are, and once they are, you see, you tell anyone that they can't have something, and they'll rush out to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the Beanie Babies or whatever? People would stand in line all night to pay $20 or whatever they were paying for a 3 cent thing. So once you start to see the shortages of silver manifest, then everyone is going to suddenly say they've got to have silver. Then everyone's going to start or stop trusting these storage programs. There's some shenanigans going on, you know, with Kitco and Perth Mint. I don't know what truth there is to it, but people are starting to question whether they can deliver on the silver they're supposedly storing for people. And once that happens, then people will insist on delivery. You don't need much of that to happen to just throw this market totally out of whack.
Well, okay. And so what you're saying is it just really needs to get public, and it needs to become a real well-known fact of how rare silver in particular is.
If you'll go to silver-investor.com or even Gold Eagle, or there's a lot of Gold Seek, I'm sure they're all talking about the reports of shortages at different places.
Mm-hmm.
Because the biggest thing is going to be those people who have sold silver short. In other words, they've sold the silver that they don't have, with the idea that they're going to make money because the price is going to go down. But what happens if the price turns around and of course then the people who actually, you know, on the long end of the contract say, fine, I want to take the silver in delivery. Then you've got a silver squeeze. They've got to come up with the silver because they've shorted. And as I said earlier, those who sell what isn't his and has to give it back or go to prison, they've got to get the silver, and that'll drive the price right through the roof. Okay?
Thank you very much, Dr. Stan. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
God bless. Thanks so much. And let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan. I just had a question for Ron. Is there any way of knowing how much of this silver future activity is connected to the Kosovo silver?
The what?
Kosovo silver. The mines in Kosovo. Well,
apparently there's some silver mines over in Kosovo.
Oh, I don't know how you'd have to look at different reports on how much their production is and where the silver is being sold to. I've heard reports that China, for example, is one of the biggest producers, but they've quit exporting any silver. So what I see happening is that the whole world, who for the last 40 years or 50 years since the dollar has been the world's reserve currency, were willing to loan to us in order to trade with us. But now they're sitting there holding trillions of dollars of our debt, and they watch our Federal Reserve and our government choosing to just inflate and devalue our currency, and they're sitting there getting a little angry because they're saying, you're just going to pay us back with worthless dollars. So the rest of the world is backing away from dollars. They want to use their dollars to buy up the gold and silver. So Kosovo, I would say that silver is not coming to the open market. It's being bought up with people with excess dollars.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
No, good enough. Thanks a lot.
Okay, fine. Let's go to Jack calling from Michigan. Jack, do you have a comment or question on this subject?
Oh, yeah. He mentioned the Federal Reserve Act, and I was wondering if he... there's actually two questions. The Federal Reserve Act was passed unanimously by the congressional conspirators, so their names didn't have to be recorded. As far as the futures options trades are going, I saw in a mailer this Interstate Gas Service Company out of Ohio is basing their prices for natural gas on NYMEX exchange gas future options. And I got to thinking, who authorized and when did all this future options trading occur? Because it seems like this is the causation of all this inflation, whatever you want to call it, speculative inflation in the rising prices of gas, oil, etc.
Well, the biggest problem, Jack, of course, is the loss of the value of our currency. Certainly the options can play a part in that. But the biggest thing is that the value of the dollar is falling, As a result, the oil-producing companies want to get something comparable to what they got 10 or 15 years ago. And, of course, the only way they can do that is to raise the price because the dollar has lost so much of its value. But thanks very much for calling, and what's your thoughts on that?
I think Mike asked a brilliant question because I have come to the conclusion over the last 5, 6 years or 30 years as I've watched this. You see, the futures market was originally created supposedly as a hedge market, so a farmer who's raising corn or wheat in March or April when he makes his plant, he might like the price of wheat at that point, so he could go into the futures market and sell his production that he's going to harvest in, September, October. And that's true with all of it. So, conceptually, it was a nice idea, but I now believe that it was created as a way for the international bankers to manipulate prices of whatever they want, because you really...
Hold that thought. All right, Ron, you were just saying how the futures market, you feel, is probably created by the international financiers so they can manipulate the markets. Would that be an accurate appraisal?
Pretty much. Either they created it for it or quickly realized that's what it could be used for.
And, of course, they're doing an excellent job of that with almost everything. They've been manipulating the price of many of the commodities down for long periods of time. They've artificially kept the price of copper and nickel and many of the other metals down for long periods of time. And unfortunately, now, of course, they're getting to be real shortages of copper, real shortages of nickel, and the prices are going up. They can no longer manipulate them artificially because there's just not enough for the tremendous demand that exists out there. Jack, are you still there?
Yes, thank you,
Do you have any?
I see what you're saying. We really have to do whatever we can locally to force the issue on restoring the gold-silver standard, right?
Right.
Absolutely. Once you created this Federal Reserve System and their ability to create this fractional reserve banking and make all the laws and change the laws at will, they can just create boom and bust at will and just consolidate power every cycle.
And this is exactly what's going on today. But I really feel that now we've reached more or less the apex of what this is all about. Everything points to the fact that the people who are in positions of control are intent upon destroying our financial system. Everything that they're doing is counterproductive. What are they doing? The big problem in the world is there's too much liquidity out there, and so what are they doing? They're adding more liquidity. They're not addressing the issue of the fact that most of our lending institutions are just plain insolvent. Of course, what we need is the free enterprise system that's working. What do they want? They want more government regulation. They have artificially created shortages in many, many products throughout the years, but the biggest thing they're doing is destroying the value of our currency. How do you destroy the value of the currency? Well, you simply keep printing more and more currency. You create inflation and you lie about it. Today, the rate of inflation in the United States is somewhere between 10 and 12%. The M3, which the government refuses to publish, but it can be calculated by economists, and they feel it's about 17%. And if things go as anticipated, why, we'll be having 17% inflation by the end of this year, and heaven help us. Ron, one more time, let's get your telephone number out.
That's 1-800-595-0561. 1-800-595-0561.
And, of course, if people do get in touch with you, what will they get?
I'll be glad to either email them or send them a package with letters and other information I put together.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Ron, one more time when we have our stations back. What is your telephone number?
That's 1-800-595-0561. That's 1-800-595-0561.
Well, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program, and it's always a stimulating thing to have you as a guest. God bless. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Ron Brown. Of course, Ron was our one of the speakers at our conference last November, I guess it was, at the end of October. Incidentally, we are having another conference. It's going to be on October 26th. If you can come, please do. We're going to have Dr. Russell Blaylock talking on medical issues. We're going to have Joanna Michelson, who is a medium, who wrote the wonderful book, The Beautiful Side of Evil, and her experiences within the occult movement, and the miracles that she saw, and the power that is there to be tapped into, but you don't want to be tapping into it, ladies and gentlemen, because you're tapping into the power that comes from the other dimension, from the Luciferian dimension. Not imaginary, but very real. You'll really enjoy Joanna Michelson. We'll have a great conference. That's going to be on the 26th of October. Why, be sure to plan on coming here to Monterey Bay. This is a beautiful time of year to be here and a beautiful place to visit. Well, of course, this is the time when we have to mention that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because quite frankly, we need your help if we're going to be able to continue maintaining the base that we have. And we don't want to have to give up our shortwave, and we don't want to have to give up any of our internet coverage or our radio stations. And we have almost 60 outlets of one sort or another every week. But maintaining this is a real job, especially when things get a little tight as they are, and I think a lot of people out there in the audience really are hurting. So if you're in a position to help us, again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV, WARP. If you want to understand what's happening financially, let me suggest my talk, Financial Tsunami. It's available in DVD or video, and then, of course, the syllabus goes with that. We have a little pamphlets. One is called The History of Money. The other is called Financial Meltdown, and they simply have to do with the newsletters we've done, and we just bundle them together in pamphlets, take some of the best articles, and so that you can begin to understand what's going on. We carry the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and if you get that to us and you specifically ask for it, why, we'll give you a DVD with the author, one of my interviews with the author. We carry the book of the Federal Reserve Conspiracy, because the Federal Reserve is a conspiracy, and it's a conspiracy of people who are dedicated to world government. And, of course, they are using their power and wealth to destroy the financial basis of this country, transfer our wealth to other nations, impoverish our people, and then, of course, bring about this world government. And you can't have a world government without a world currency. That is why they've set out to destroy the value of the American currency. And believe me, they're well along the way to do that. And you better find out now what you can do to protect your wealth, or you may very well end up like the people in Zimbabwe today, in a nation where the United States State Department forced Robert Mugabe, a lifelong Marxist, in as there as the leader, with the assurance from Henry Kissinger to the Rhodesian people, just trust us. Just trust us. Why, we would never let chaos come to your country. If things ever get out of hand, America will be there. He gave the word of this country, and, well, of course, he betrayed those people. Ladies and gentlemen, men and women become accomplices of the evils they fail to oppose. We have evil working at the highest levels of our government, personified by Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, and, of course, the Rockefeller family, that employs both of them, one for the Democrats, one for the Republicans, so we can go to the polls and vote every 4 years for the candidate of their choice, not our choice, as is happening this time. So, our number, 1-800-544-8927, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion. It's going to determine what the future will bring, and I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, for this next hour, they're going to be the views of Barry Shamish, who's an Israeli patriot. He's an investigative reporter. He's written extensively about the criminal activity of the people at the highest echelons of the Israeli government and the fact that they, working with the people here in the United States, are intent upon destroying Israel. And as incredible as it may seem, after you've listened to Barry for a while, why you become increasingly convinced that he has access to information we're not actually getting from other sources, and there really are people over in Israel who are intent upon the destruction of that country, and of course the destruction of our own country as well here in the United States. Well, this evening we're going to talk about a recent tragedy over in Israel, but as a background to that, do you remember when we had the Columbine Massacre here in Littleton, Colorado, and of course a couple of students were actually killed, a number of other students, but the police refused to go in. And they waited until all the shooting was over and everything was done, and only then did they go in and try to rescue a few of the wounded people that they could salvage. And then, of course, we had a recent shooting in Virginia Tech. And you remember that the police, knowing full well that the murder was loose, did not notify anybody, and of course when this fellow started shooting there in one of the laboratories, why, the police didn't go in. They waited for a good long time before going in. And a recent attack over in Israel there at a school, and where you have students with no defenses at all. There's supposed to be guards there to protect them, but of course an Arab terrorist went in. And but I'm going to let Barry Shamish tell you the story. But as I contemplate this story, and I think what happened at Littleton, I think what happened at Virginia Tech, and I ask, what's happened to the police? Why aren't they protecting the people? Barry, you pick up the story from there.
Yeah, I've written about this twice, and I'm going to write once more, because last night a friend of mine named Chaim, a very good friend, as a matter of fact, phoned me up, and he said, look, I was in Merkaz Harav. That was the yeshiva attacked 3 weeks ago with 8 dead and 11 wounded. He was huddled in a room above where the killing took place in the library. What he told me was that he was with friends. They shut off the lights. One person tried to phone the police on a cell phone, and everyone just told them not to do it, not to give away their location. And what Chaim told me is, first of all, he heard the screams from below him, from the kids being killed, and he didn't really go into grand details of what they sounded like, but he said he's just recovered from it. Undoubtedly, this was a tremendously traumatic incident in his life, and I almost lost my friend. But he said the Arab stayed in the library, and he had a theory on that he found his ruse and was afraid to come out. He thought he'd be shot, but whatever, he stayed in the library and didn't get to my friend's room. Otherwise, he would have been just another victim, and I would have lost a friend. But Chaim told me he cleared up a lot of the questions I've been asking and I've asked on the show. He said, don't even think about the people who are terrorists. It doesn't matter if the press got their stories wrong.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. All right, go ahead, Barry.
Oh, yes.
He said, just leave them alone. There was a bad press, and it came out funny. But he said there were questions. Number one, we were told the police were there in 20 minutes. Now, by the way, for anyone who does know anything about terror in Israel, and especially in Jerusalem, there's supposed to be local policemen there in seconds. Every neighborhood has got police cars. There was no excuse for the 20 minutes that we were told. But Chaim told me, he said, we were down on the floor. He says, I'll bet you it was 40 minutes before we heard the police come in into the yeshiva. And I said, are you sure about that? I asked him, I said, you know, 20 minutes and 40, that's double. And he says, I realize that in our circumstance where every second seemed like an eternity, that maybe time was twisted, but he said a minimum half an hour before we heard the forces come into the yeshiva. He said, I'll guess 40, minimum half an hour. Now look, that doesn't happen in Jerusalem. If there's a terror attack, you have the forces there within minutes. You have preliminary forces. You may not have the SWAT teams there, but you've got the police going into yeshiva within minutes. And for some reason, Chaim said outright 40 minutes. And he said it was an eternity to us. There's something very, very wrong with this, and Chaim told me that as well. He said, where were they? Well, we were lying on the floor, and our friends were getting killed. Where were the police? And then Chaim said, look, you wrote about no guard being in the yeshiva. He said, you have to understand, a year ago, all the guards were lifted throughout Jerusalem. At the bus stops, on the buses, he said, it was a public announcement that they were taking away guards. And he said, a year ago, we had a guard. And it just went with the rest of Jerusalem. The city got lax, and we didn't have a guard. He said, it's a shame. An armed guard managing a security detail would have prevented the terrorists from coming in. But he said, the whole city is like this. Don't blame the yeshiva. I think he was being a little apologetic there. But it's true, there was no guard at the yeshiva. He confirmed that to me. He said the terrorists who he watched, them through a window.
This is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Barry Shamish, and he was just saying that his friend who was there at the yeshiva when this massacre took place here a little over a week ago, was able to watch what was going on. That he says that it was not 20 minutes, but closer to 40 minutes before the police got there. That there was no guard there, but then of course they'd pulled the guards out of all the buses, out of all the schools. Why would they do that with the terrorist threat? Why would they leave the other people open and susceptible to terrorist attack? But you were saying your friend was watching this. How was he able to watch it?
I believe it was. And now again, I have to go and see where he was. But he saw Dadon shoot the terrorist. Dadon was one of the two shooters of the terrorists, and he knew him personally. And he said he watched them through the window, gaining a position outside the library. He was waiting on a rooftop outside the library. He explained this to me. There was a window and a partition, and he got comfortable. Nonetheless, it's hard for us to imagine, but he saw Dadon shoot the terrorist. And again, he was, right in the yeshiva. That's where he studies, and we'll just take his word that he saw what he saw. He said the killer was a huge guy, but he said, I made a mistake with the cardboard box. He had 20 magazine clips, 600 bullets is how many bullets he took into the yeshiva. And I wrote, I said, how can an Arab walk through Jerusalem holding a Kalashnikov and 600 bullets without raising the suspicion of anybody? He said, first of all, he wore the bullets. There was no cardboard box. He walks into yeshiva with the bullets under his vest, under some kind of a vest, and he said he didn't have to take them out of a box. He pulled them off his body. And now here's the important thing I asked in my article. I said, how could he get there? Was he going to take a bus, a taxi, holding 600 bullets and a Kalashnikov? I guess the weight would be about 60 pounds. I don't know if you've ever taken bullets into battle. I have. We had a bullet clip, a belt that held eight clips, and it was pretty darn heavy. Where do you put 20 clips with 30 bullets each and a Kalashnikov and be able to walk into yeshiva? He said he spoke to friends, and this is not being reported in the media. He said many people saw he arrived in a car, and there were two other Arabs in the car, and he simply walked out of that car and straight to the yeshiva. He said he had help. It was not a lone killer. There were other Arabs involved. That fact is nowhere. You can't find that fact. And it only makes sense. I mean, a lone shooter. Who gave him the gun? I mean, realistically, there are no lone shooters with 600 bullets and a Kalashnikov rifle living in Jerusalem. This had to have been organized. And as near as anyone can figure, no one knows who organized it. He said the killer was simply a monster. He ran into the library and shot everyone within sight. He said he was also a very bad shot. One lucky victim, he called it a miracle, was shot at about 10 times and he missed him and managed to get away. Another moved the barrel of the gun away from him and ran away. I don't know if these are miracles. These are just desperate people getting away from terrorists. But nonetheless, he said once he shot the victims, he would come up to them and shoot them over and over again, supposedly to make sure they were dead. He just called them a monster. And I said to him, look, Chaim, you know that Merkaz Harav is the religious and philosophical center of religious Zionism. I said, you know it wasn't an accident that yeshiva was hit. And he said, well, it could have been any yeshiva. And I said, no, it couldn't. If you want to lower the morale of religious Zionism, the last holdouts in Israel, the last patriots in the country, you attack their religious center. I said, in my opinion, our government had a major role in this operation, and he asked me why, and I said, well, to lower morale and to sap your strength. And he says, well, they don't know us very well, because if you think that by killing our kids you're lowering our morale, you just don't understand us. And actually, I believe that the settlers have shown over and over again that their morale can't be lowered by mere killing. But nonetheless, 8 kids dead, 11 more wounded. And what he said also to me, Chaim, as I explained on this show, the Arabs' family set up a memorial tent to their son. And believe me, when I was a soldier in Israel, if anyone had done such a thing in Jerusalem, had celebrated a monster who killed 8 and wounded another 11 with a memorial tent where the celebrants would come and congratulate the family on what a great son they had, we would have shut that tent down and arrested anyone who got near such a monstrosity. And Chaim says, I can't figure that one out. I guess he still has some beliefs that the government is looking out for him. He said that made no sense to anybody. His major problems, well, not so much problems, but he says the kid didn't work alone, and they're making it like a lone shooter. He said that's not what happened. Kids in our yeshiva saw him arrive by car with two other Arabs. And he said that's just not being broadcast by anybody. And he said there's something wrong with that story. And he said the police reaction, 40 minutes, he said, I was in that room. He said, where were the police? Why wasn't our police there to rescue us? And I guess overall that's my story. That's the phone call I had with my friend Chaim last night.
All right, fine. Well, I think it's a good question because, of course, we could ask the same question for Virginia Tech. We could ask the same question from Columbine. And when you begin to see this pattern erupt, appear time after time after time, you begin to realize this is not accidental. Somebody is giving orders, and it is not to get in there and rescue the people.
Oh, that's for sure. Now, I brought up, it was an, look, to Israelis, this was probably the most, well, the best-known massacre. It's part of Israeli history. It'll never be forgotten, and that's the Hebron massacre of February 24th, 1994, supposedly, by Baruch Goldstein. Now, I brought it up along with the Merkaz HaRav massacre because, in my opinion, they were done by the same people. And, well, it was the government, once again, trying to destroy the last patriots left in the country because it doesn't fit their peace plan. Now, I'm going to dive into something, and again, I'll do it slowly, and that is the government set up a Baruch Goldstein. He didn't kill a soul.
All right, now you're really going to have to tell people who Goldstein was and how this whole thing came about.
All right, we'll do it. We'll do it that way.
Right.
Baruch Goldstein was a doctor. He lived in Hebron. He was a major in the army. He was a very mild-mannered person who helped Arabs, Jews. He showed no prejudice. Then on February 24th of 1994, supposedly, I mean, I broke this story. It was as big as Rabin. My work on Goldstein was just as big as Rabin in many circles in Israel. Because I uncovered the fact that it was not Goldstein. Goldstein didn't kill a soul. And I followed the Commission of Inquiry, and I had help. Again, without the help I've been getting through the years, I couldn't do anything. But Goldstein was blamed for killing 39 Arabs out of 51. 51 died. Even the Commission of Inquiry admitted that Israeli soldiers killed numerous Arabs outside the mosque who were misbehaving. But the point is, Baruch Goldstein supposedly walked into the Hebron Mosque. Well, it's the Cave of the Patriarchs. It's a very famous shrine for holy to Jews and Arabs. When it's not a mosque, it's a synagogue, but that's neither here nor there. Early in the morning, it's a mosque. And he started shooting everybody in sight, and 39 died in a minute and a half of shooting.
That's what
the army said. Now, I'm going to tell you what really happened. Are we prepared?
Right, go right ahead.
All right. Baruch Goldstein gets a phone call in the middle of the night. He was on Milouin, army duty. He's called for an emergency. He's needed as a doctor. How do we know that? He wrote a note to his wife, Miriam, in the middle of the night saying, I am away on Milouin, or I am on army duty. He arrives by jeep, by the way. I know who the driver was. And it was a man's name was Eliyahu Spitzer. I know who the other passenger was. That was Monty Unger. They drove Goldstein to the mosque in an army jeep.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Pick this story up. Anyway, of course, a couple of people drive Goldstein to the mosque in Hebron, and of course, is he armed at the time? Do we know at all?
Well, yeah, he's on Army duty.
All right, fine.
Now, look, a jeep can only take a soldier on reserve duty to his post. It can't take a worshiper to his synagogue. This is important, very important, because Marion Goldstein gets his message, gets the message from her husband, the note, and phones the local IDF commander. His name is Shaul Edelstein, Shlomo Edelstein. And this is essential in its own way, because Shlomo Edelstein tells Miriam Goldstein, remember his wife, that he believes that her husband was taken to the Cave of the Machpelah, Cave of the Patriarchs, to pray. And now, in this phone conversation, Miriam went crazy because she told him he doesn't pray at the cave. He never prays at the cave. Now, this is important because there was a commission of inquiry held, remember, 1 year before the Rabin Commission inquiry. Literally, 1 year before. And it was headed by the same Chief Justice, Meir Shamgar. Now,
no, but I think it's important that I think our listeners, Barry, know what happens. Is he Goldstein is taken to the mosque there. You know, it's early in the morning. It's obviously it's going to be filled with Muslims. He is a major in the military. He would not be going there to pray at that time of morning because the Muslims are there. So what happens? So they understand, you know, what happened, you know, and then, of course, after that, there had to be a committee of inquiry. But what happened when he got there?
Well, I'm quoting from the committee of inquiry.
Okay.
And this is important because Shlomo Edelstein denied that Baron Goldstein phoned him twice, and the committee of inquiry brought the phone records and proved that she did phone him twice. This is important because he never prayed at his mosque. This isn't a place he would go to pray. And look, he put on his uniform. A person only puts on their army uniform if they're called into army duty. Now, remember, he's a doctor. A doctor is called quite often into the army at strange hours because there are people heard the explosions and by gunfire. So it wouldn't have been strange for Goldstein to get a phone call saying you're on reserve duty and we're sending a jeep for you. And he wouldn't have wanted to wake his wife. This was on the morning of the Purim holiday. I'm sure he would have let her sleep in. He left her a note. He got the jeep and he drove to the mosque. This is at least the start of the story. Now, I'm going to confuse you, and I tried not to. I made notes, and they're in front of me. It's a bit complicated, but just keep in mind, the soldiers are gone. The police are gone. The mosque is empty of security forces. The reason the police are gone is as Goldstein leaves the house, an Arab is shot in Kiryat Arba, that's next to Hebron, and all the police from the mosque go and investigate the shooting. So that's it. No police in the mosque. And as for soldiers, let's just say the excuse was they overslept. There was only one soldier inside the mosque.
Hold that thought.
And there were three soldiers outside the mosque, and that's it.
Hold that thought, Barry. Let me just clear out for our listeners now. We're talking about Goldstein. Goldstein is a military officer, reserve military officer. He's called in the middle of the night, and he thinks he's going to be going someplace to help people. He's driven in a military jeep to the mosque in Hebron, and of course there are no soldiers there. Ordinarily there'd be soldiers there guarding, to make sure there was no violence there. All the police are all gone. They're all gone because somebody's been killed adjacent to that area. So here's Goldstein. Here's this mosque there at the place where the patriarchs are buried. And this can be used as a synagogue, can be used as a mosque, or at this time of morning it'll be used as a mosque. So pick up the story from there, Barry.
Now, I'm going to summarize it and then go backwards.
All right.
All right. Goldstein has woken up. He's taken by an army chief to the Cave of the Patriarchs. What we are told is he walked in to the mosque where 600 worshippers were praying and started shooting it up. But there are major problems with this. Number one, there are two groups of soldiers. One at the front gate, one at the mosque gate. The front gate is outside. The mosque is inside the Cave of the Patriarchs. It's a little bit of ways. The soldiers outside say Goldstein arrived at 4:45 in the morning. The one soldier inside, only one that says six, says he saw Goldstein pass him at 5:20 a.m. The soldiers outside claim that Goldstein entered carrying an M16. The soldier inside said no, he was carrying a Galil. The shooting was done with a Galil. Three soldiers saw someone they know as Goldstein arrive at 4:45 carrying a weapon that wasn't used in the massacre. The soldier inside sees him at 5:20, but Goldstein doesn't enter the mosque. He goes somewhere else and then enters the mosque from behind. Nonetheless, two separate groups of soldiers. One sees him at 4:45 enter. One sees him at 5:20 enter. One sees him with an M16. One sees him with a Galil. This is actual testimony. Goldstein, now here is where it gets interesting. All of the Arabs, on the day of the massacre, an Arab journalist named Abu Khalid Tuwama went to six hospitals to interview the survivors of the massacres from ages 9 to 80. 25 of them all swore that there were three shooters. All of them. All the Arabs that he interviewed, most said three, some said two, none said zero. None. And this is absolutely, of course, impossible to set up a conspiracy that early in the day after a massacre with everyone agreeing there were three people inside the mosque.
But, I mean, apparently somebody went into the mosque and started shooting, Barry. This is the important thing. Goldstein is there. He's in that area. And he's...
No one died in the mosque from shooting.
Right. Because then, of course, somebody goes into the mosque, and apparently three people go into the mosque and start shooting and just kill an awful lot of...
Nobody shot any Arabs. They weren't shot.
They weren't shot.
No, you're jumping now.
All right, go ahead.
Let's go backwards. Goldstein enters the mosque through a side door on the Jewish side of the mosque. It's called Abraham Hall. The door is bolted. Someone has the key and opens it. Goldstein, or whoever it was, enters thinking he's going to help sick, wounded people. He's a doctor on duty. He's with two other soldiers. We'll get to that shortly. Three are spotted. The TV camera, lo and behold, isn't working, so we'll never know, because on that morning the TV camera inside the mosque wasn't working. Three soldiers entered. Now here is what happens. Number one, there were six blank bullets shot. We know that because the police found the cartridges. We know that. That's in the testimony of the Shamgar Commission. There were two stun grenades thrown. We know that because every witness, Jew and Arab, heard two grenades before the shooting. They all heard the grenades just before the shooting, and there was no shrapnel. At that point, after the stun grenades are thrown and the blank bullets are shot into the crowd, the two officers accompanying Goldstein run out of the mosque, close the door behind them, and lock it. Now,
hold that thought.
All right.
Oh. Okay, Dr. Stan, and of course, and now Goldstein is locked in the mosque there, of course, and somebody's thrown a couple of stuns and grenades, and somebody, of course, has fired six shots. Were there any bullets? You say these were dummy bullets?
They were just cartridges.
Just cartridges.
Cartridges were found on the floor that didn't belong to Goldstein.
Okay.
Okay, this is all in the testimony. Now Goldstein is locked into the mosque all by himself, and he is facing a crowd in total panic. Now, the first thing is he tries to get out, but the door is locked, and he's screaming, "Let me out, let me out." No one is opening the door for him. And by the way, one of the panel of the Shamgar Commission was an Arab judge named Zuabi, and Zuabi he was the only judge with a damn on this commission. He said, if, in fact, Goldstein walked in through Abraham Hall, that's the side hall, and he couldn't get out because the door was bolted, then he wasn't alone. It's that simple. If the door was bolted, it was bolted from the outside, and Goldstein was on the inside. That simple. Judge Zuabi made the connection to the conspiracy and said so openly. Goldstein was now all alone in a fiery mob. And not just a fiery mob. The witnesses said that somebody, a provocateur, an agent, opened a closet inside the mosque and handed out 20 iron clubs. Goldstein was clubbed to death. I met the coroner who got his body parts. He said he was like a cow slaughtered into 1,000 pieces. There were weapons inside the mosque. Goldstein was now alone, and he first shot in the air. This is what a soldier does. If you don't want to harm anyone, and Goldstein didn't want to harm anyone, he shot in the air. And how do we know that? Because the police found his two bullets in the roof of the mosque. They found them. Now, of the people hurt, and this is very, very important, of the dead, initially it was 29 dead. Every one of them were over the age of 60. Of the wounded, every one of them were hit by shrapnel. They were hit by stones from the floor. They were hit by bullet shrapnel.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Barry Shamish, and he's telling us the story of the Hebron Massacre, and of course, supposedly when Goldstein, a doctor, goes in, is somehow lured into the mosque, and then somebody throws a couple of grenades into the worshippings there, and then, of course, the people, you know, who are with Goldstein rush out of the room and lock the door and leave him in there with the Arabs. Well, they're furious. A number had been killed from from the shrapnel.
They were trampled.
Really?
They were all over the age of 60. They were on their knees praying. Suddenly, there's two. You know what some guy said the grenades were? Some guy said the grenades were the imam of the mosque hitting the microphone twice. Boom, boom, those are the grenades. That's what some guy came up with. Like people don't know the difference between a microphone and a grenade. Everybody, Jew and Arab, heard the grenades.
Okay, finding that a lot of people were hit by the shrapnel from the grenades?
No, there was no shrapnel.
There wasn't any.
They were trampled.
They're trampled, okay.
This was 600 people in a tiny room, and they're terrified. They're trying to get out. And the old people are trampled in the panic. And you have to read the reports. There are medical reports on the wounded. There are none on the dead. This was also in the Shamgar Commission report. There were none on the dead. They were all over 60 years old. Now, what you have is you have Goldstein, first of all, shooting in the air, which is what you do when you want to keep a crowd away from you. You shoot a warning shot. They found his bullets in the ceiling of the mosque, two of them. How did they get there? Because they shot in the air first. And next, all of the wounded, I mean all, there are no exceptions to this, were hit below the waist, mostly in their shins, because when the warning shots didn't work, Goldstein shot on the ground. And when you shoot the ground, the bullets shatter the stone floor, and they go flying into legs. All of the wounded inside the mosque, all of them, were hit below the waist. That could only happen if somebody is not trying to kill. He's trying to distance the crowd away from him. The dead were trampled to death. Goldstein did not shoot one of them. There were no shooting deaths inside the mosque. But it gets worse. Now, again, I read the report, and I'm jumping right to the end, but I'll go backwards after this. According to the witnesses, one was director general of the hospital in Hebron, another was a member of the local municipality. These were top-notch Arab witnesses. What they said was there were soldiers shooting from the roofs outside the Cave of the Patriarchs. They were shooting everybody who tried to escape the mosque. Goldstein, according to the IDF, was responsible for the deaths of 29. There were 51 dead at the Cave of the Patriarchs. At least 21 of them were Israeli soldiers on the rooftops picking off anyone who tried to escape the mosque, including the imam who Shamgar, again, he was the chief commissar of the commission investigating the massacre. They shot the imam. You will never know if he hit the microphone or not. He was one of the first ones to die. This was an attempt to get the Jews out of Hebron. This was set up by Israel Shabak. Now, I'm going to jump ahead. There is a department called the Jewish Department. They are the ones doing the nasty, horrible job on the settlers and anyone opposed to the Oslo peace. The head of the Jewish Department, on the day that so-called Goldstein's massacre occurred, was Carmi Gilon. Now, he was not called to give evidence at this Shamgar Commission, possibly because his brother, Ilan Gilon, was the register of the court. He was the one who registered the witnesses, and he got his brother out of actually testifying. Now, if you're head of the Jewish Department, which is supposed to surveil radical Jews, and if you do a muff-up like the Hebron massacre, you would expect to be fired. That's what you would expect. Carmi Gilon was rewarded by being made head of the entire Shabak right after the massacre. He was in on the planning. This was a Shabak killing planned through and through. Now, have I generalized enough for you that I can start doing details?
Go right ahead.
Now, Dick, I know this is tough. This is an investigation. No one else did this but me, you know. And I'm dead serious. Everyone else just said that Goldstein was the killer and the right wings are really crazy. And I was the only one who went to the trouble of actually following the commission and looking at the inconsistencies and then interviewing people like the second in command of the police lab that checked Goldstein's so-called bullets. And he told me outright not one bullet that he checked was from Goldstein's gun. Well, what can you say? I did the coroner who put together Goldstein's body before he was buried. He said he was chopped up like a cow. There was an axe inside a mosque. Where'd the axe come from? Next. Supposedly, Goldstein shot 111 bullets in a minute and a half. That's the Israeli government conclusion. Every police expert said that's impossible. And all the people inside the mosque said the shooting went on for at least 3 minutes. Others said up to 5 minutes. he did not shoot 111 boats in a minute and a half and kill 29 people. That can't be done. But it's more to the point, Goldstein was inside the mosque, but he wasn't alone. And here is how we know. Here is some of the testimony that Shamgar dismissed. There were three soldiers on the outside of the compound. I knew their names very, very well. They were Yosef Drori and Eli Melech. They claimed that when Goldstein entered the mosque at 4:45, he was followed seconds later by a settler they didn't know carrying a Lilon or a Galil rifle. No one knows who the settler was, but Goldstein did not enter alone. Those three soldiers said so. Now we have the other soldier inside the mosque, and his name was Rotem. I met his sister-in-law at the Jerusalem Book Fair, and what she says is this, what the soldiers saw was right. Something was going on inside that mosque where Goldstein was unknown to the Arabs, showed up at 4:45 and then 5:20. She said at 4:45 it wasn't Goldstein who showed up. Her brother-in-law, Rotem, who testified that Goldstein showed up at 5:20 and didn't pass him into the mosque, was telling the truth. Now remember, this is a trial. In the trial, you've got three soldiers who are saying Goldstein arrived at 4:45. You have one soldier inside who's saying that Goldstein arrived at 5:20. What does Shamgar do? Shamgar decides that he arrived at 5:20. Now, he dismissed all the evidence of the soldiers. He simply decided they were mistaken. Of the Arabs who all saw three shooters, except for a couple who only saw two shooters, he decided they were lying. This is what he did. Every piece of evidence that was of use to prove that Goldstein was not the sole shooter, or he wasn't the shooter at all, was dismissed by Shamgar. This was 1 year before he headed the commission which whitewashed the Rabin assassination. He made the shooter. Goldstein didn't shoot. Goldstein was a doctor lured into that mosque, and he was the pretend assassin. He was a patsy. That's who Goldstein was. Am I making this clear?
Yes, uh-huh, yes, sir. I think it's a fascinating story, and the question is, why would anybody go to all this trouble to set Goldstein up to get him locked in the mosque?
Get the Jews out of Hebron.
Right.
That's why. Look, I've heard from many people that this was the end of Rabin. The idea was that the Arabs were going to massacre Jews in revenge, and the IDF were going to come and, for their own good, take all the Jews out of Hebron and turn it over to the Arabs. Rabin objected to this, and I've heard he signed his death warrant when he said he wouldn't play ball with that scheme. I've heard that from people who do know things, who are pretty darn high up in the Israeli command structure, told me that Rabin refused to send the soldiers in. Now, keep something in mind before I go backwards into the massacre. Everybody asks why Netanyahu, when he was elected prime minister in March of 97, 3 years later, didn't even spend 10 days before he pulled Israel out of Hebron. Remember, Israel controlled Hebron. It was a major card in any negotiations. It was supposed to be traded for peace. There are many, many reasons why you simply didn't walk out of Hebron for nothing. And yet Netanyahu walked out for nothing. And what people don't understand is the role of the Waqf, the religious authority of the Muslims, who also had guards inside the Cave of the Patriarchs that morning. The Rock promised. And again, this is all in my book, Israel Betrayed. This whole ugly story is in this book. It's at Lulu, and we'll get to that. But the Rock explained that they were going to testify at the Shamgar Commission on behalf of both peoples. That's what he said. On behalf of both peoples, they were going to testify to the truth of what went on. And I have the quotes from the Israeli press about destroyed evidence. Look, I'm looking. Yes, Sheikh Salah Natcha was the Rock Sheikh who was going to lead his guards to present what he calls the Rock officials were true witnesses, and he said the authorities made it difficult to see what happened when they cleaned the place. They destroyed the evidence, and the Rock was going to tell the truth of what happened that day, but something happened to the Rock. And in the end, they all went on vacation and didn't testify. There was one Rock official who testified to the government's story, and all other guards, guards, didn't show up at the commission. They were all... What I heard was a deal was cut. We'll get out of Hebron at the next opportunity. It'll be within 3 years. There'll be no more Israel in Hebron if you don't testify. And Netanyahu was the savior of this deal. He pulled out of Hebron 10 days after he was elected, promising that he would not push forward the Oslo so-called peace. He pulled out of Hebron within 10 days.
All right, now, do you have any idea what the Arabs would have testified had they shown up?
They would have testified that Goldstein wasn't the shooter, that the Israeli soldiers outside the mosque were the real killers, that they were set up on the rooftops to kill anyone who tried to escape the mosque. They would have told the whole story. They would have said that there were metal rods being hidden in a closet inside the mosque and distributed to the worshippers to butcher Goldstein. They would have talked about the door being locked behind Goldstein and him being trapped in the mosque. They would have discussed. They would have testified that Goldstein walked in with two other soldiers. The whole thing, they would have told the whole story. Look, even the simple Arabs, the ones in the hospital, weren't stupid. They all saw three soldiers, and they said so.
Okay, well, before we go on, I want you to get out your telephone number. I want you to get out your website and tell people how they can get hold of your book.
Well, this is tough. This is a tough one to... this is a very tough subject to make sense out of, isn't it?
No, I can follow along. I've heard about the second or third time, and I'm beginning to get the picture. Go ahead. But obviously, Goldstein was set up. They wanted an incident. They got their incident. And
Goldstein was a member of the JDL, of Koch.
Oh, I see.
He was a perfect setup. He hadn't been a member in quite a while, but he lived in Kiryat Arba next to Hebron. He was a doctor. A doctor and a major. If there was an incident, he would not have found it unusual to be called in the middle of the night. He was a perfect patsy.
Well, they always seem to have a patsy, whether it's a James Earl Ray, whether it's a Saran or Lee Harvey Oswald. Barry, let's go ahead and get out your
yes, okay.
Website.
So this particular story of the Goldstein so-called massacre, which again was not a massacre. It was a massacre, except he didn't do it. It's in my book, Israel Betrayed. That's at lulu.com. www.lulu.com, and in the right hand corner it says search. You go in that little box and you write my name, Chamish, Chamish, and that'll get you Israel Betrayed. This was my first book after who murdered his cockroach bean, and lo and behold, they did it with Goldstein, and I'll tell you how I found out the information shortly. My website, just do www.barrychalmers.com, and I have, are you going to get a good present, Dr. Stan? I have a new DVD.
Okay.
It was professionally filmed in New York when I was there a month and a half ago by a guy who was on Jay Leno, and New York Times wrote about him, but he doesn't want credit for this. He's got his own religious circles. And it's my very first interview. It's called Taking Israel Back. And it's a very witty interview, actually, but the soul of the interview is what we can do to take the country back while there's time and if there's time.
All right, fine. Well, I'll really look forward to getting that.
Now, anyone who wants it, here's my... That's coming in the mail this week. Incidentally, we got your DVD yesterday, and Cindy and I are looking forward to seeing Israeli War Miracles, according to the cover. Thank you very much for that. And yeah. My phone number is 904-4... My cell is 904-501-0079. That's 904-501-7605. Now, how much time do we have?
Well, we've got about a minute and a half.
Oh, then, well, we did as well as... Did we get the story out? What do you think?
I think you got it out. It's a hard story to understand, but I have no question at all what you're saying. And that is that Goldstein was a patsy, that they precipitated this incident, and they left him there to die.
Yes. In short, yes. But the proofs are just enormous. And you'll find some of them on my website under the archive, and it says articles, and go into the archive. Otherwise, get the book. I mean, this is how you bring down Israel, and this is what I despise about the establishment. They don't care who they murder to get their damn peace. It can be Jews, it can be Arabs, anyone who stands in the way, they don't care how much bloodshed is spilt, as long as they get their way.
Well, I think it's a tragic situation that there are people who have no human compassion or concern about human life or suffering. And unfortunately, it's a recurrent pattern in Israel, as you pointed out. And, of course, it's a recurrent pattern right here in the United States, as we point out again and again and again, whether it be the murder of a president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, or his brother, Robert Kennedy, or Martin Luther King, or so many others, they have been simply murdered, and everything has been done to cover up the truth. And that, of course, is what you're pointing out with Goldstein, Rabin, and so many others.
And because of Rav Yeshiva, were both done by the same SOBs, utterly, utterly ruining Israel.
Amen to that. Well, but we're out of time, Barry, but we'll be talking, I think, is it tomorrow morning?
Yes, it is.
All right, fine. Well, God bless, and we'll look forward to telling the same story again.
I will.
One of these times I got to get
it
done. God bless. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that's very good. Shamish, always a very, very informative guest, but his message is really very simple. The leadership of Israel are intent upon destroy Israel, just as the leaders of America are intent upon destroying America. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when I have to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope if you're out there across America and you're in a position to help, that many of you will consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And it's especially important at this time because, of course, many of our regular supporters are having financial problems. I'm sure a lot of people are having financial problems across America, and of course, but we want to maintain our coverage because we are a voice. We're helping many people to understand what is really going on. And just as Barry Shamish is hoping to convince people over in Israel what's going on, and believe me, this program is heard in Israel on the Internet and perhaps even by shortwave transmission, but Certainly we have the opportunity to get the information out. We need your help so we can continue doing what we do best. And of course, we do hope that many of you will want to get some of the other information that we have. Do you know that we have a secret government? Do you know anything about the Council on Foreign Relations and how certainly every Secretary of State, every Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, every Chairman of the Federal Reserve System, whether it be Republican or Democrat, they always come from the same little organization. But what we will point out that nobody else will point out is that the Council on Foreign Relations is a front for a secret society. It was called the Round Table. But, of course, the Round Table is simply a front for the Circle of Initiates, which is a front for the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created in 1891. It's like an onion. It has layer after layer after layer. But the outer layer is the Council on Foreign Relations, and there we find David Rockefeller, the chairman of the board for 15, vice chairman of the board, 15 years, chairman of the board from about 1965 to 1980, and then, of course, now chairman emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. This is a Rockefeller-controlled institution dedicated to the destruction of the sovereignty of America, and, of course, creating this one world government. This is what it's all about. And behind that are powerful spiritual forces. And what everybody has missed is that the origin, whether it be the Council on Foreign Relations or the Trilateral Commission or the Bilderbergers or the Club of Rome or Masonry or Rosicrucianism or Theosophy or Opus Dei, all of these have their origin in the occult. Until people understand that, they can't understand anything going on. Since the inception of dawning of civilization, why, of course, there have been secret societies and mystery religions, and they carry forward to this very time that we're living in, the most important and exciting time in history, because the ultimate goal is the world government, the new world religion, and the new world leader. And believe me, everything is being done to destroy the sovereignty of our nation. That's what the financial crisis is about. Everything's being done to destroy Christianity and to replace it with another religion, a universal religion, where we all worship the same God. The God of the Shinto and the Buddhist and the Hindu and the Muslim and the Jew and the Christian, all the same God. Well, that's not, of course, what Christianity is about. Christianity is an exclusive religion. It says there is only one God, and he's not the God of the Muslim and not the God of the Hindu. Of course, this is the God of the Bible. And, of course, his name, of course, is Jesus Christ. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we do hope many of you will go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Pull down our material. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or get the DVD. You need to watch my talk on the forbidden secret. You need to understand that there really are secret societies and spiritual forces out there. And you need, of course, to get my talk, certainly on the hidden agenda. You need to get our 4-tape set on the supernatural, and the book that goes with that by Joanna Michelson, The Beautiful Side of Evil, because Joanna was a medium, and she was in contact with the supernatural, with the beings from the other dimension. And then, of course, you need to get our book on satanic crimes, the 4-tape set, and so much more. Go to RadioLiberty.com. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, and then pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.